Welcome back to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm Richard Deitch. My producer, as always, is Bette Marston. This is episode 7 of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Thank you so much for the excellent feedback that you've been giving me on Twitter, on iTunes. I really, really appreciate it. Today's guest, really excited about it, somebody I respect in the business greatly, Bob Lee of ESPN. Bob is ESPN's longest-serving commentator. Actually joined the network as a SportsCenter anchor on its third day of operation, September 9th, 1979. It's amazing. September 9th, 1979, Bob Lee's first date at ESPN. You know him as the host of Outside the Lines. He has been there since that show's inception in May 1990. They have a big anniversary coming up in July. I believe they have an anniversary show July 7th, I believe. Bob Lee, as well, has been a preeminent voice on that network's soccer coverage. He's been the host of the 2010 and 2014 World Cup, both from South Africa and Brazil, hosted the 2011 Women's World Cup from Germany, was a lead commentator for the World Cup in 1998, and he has just been a major part of ESPN soccer coverage. He's a Spurs fan in the Premier League, and, basically, Bob Lee is, and this is an expression that people have used at ESPN, is the conscience of ESPN or the journalism conscience of ESPN. And I think you saw that on his work, even as recently when he and Jeremy Schapp were on the air, what seemed like for hours after hours when Sepp Blatter announced his resignation. So he, for ESPN, is one of the sort of the beacons when it comes to journalism there. They're very lucky to have him. All right, Bette Marston does not like long intros, so we'll end it here. Let's bring on Bob Lee of ESPN. Okay, and as promised, here is Bob Lee, straight out of Bristol, I believe. Bob, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Straight out of Bristol. Straight cash, homie.
Yeah, you know, Bob, before we even get into this, you dropped a very famous line from The Wire during your FIFA coverage.
I am an OG.
Have you ever dropped a line from The Wire on the air prior to that?
Actually, that was the second time I used it. It used to come with the king, you best not miss. I might have. I'm not one of those poor, deluded people who think that by deconstructing The Wire across five seasons, I understand the inner city of America any better. I can just admire it for what it is. It's a tremendously well-done piece of entertainment. But, yeah, we all love it. In fact, in the wake of all of that, somehow, Isaiah Whitlock, who portrays Clay Davis, learned that by mail notification is his infamous, and I can say it on a podcast, shit. So every time I get an email, I hear Senator Clay Davis with his exclamation, and Isaiah and I have hooked up on Twitter, so we're hoping to, you know, maybe bring him through here for a tour.
I like that. And then I believe Isaiah is he's an active person on Twitter.
He is, and a lot of the guys from Dominic Lombardozzi as well, they're out there, and so it's neat when you're able to click on somebody who does accept DMs, and so you can get a little conversation going offline.
Yeah, very, very cool. All right, one of the things, Bob, about this podcast, and a number of your colleagues have been on it, from Adam Schefter to Scott Van Pelt, there's a lot of, at least the people who have been listening, there's been a lot of interest in process, which makes me happy, because process is very interesting to me. So in terms of a day that you will host Outside the Lines, and let's, as opposed to a Sunday, let's make it an afternoon day, can you take the listeners through what that day is like from the time you arrive at ESPN and as specific as you can, what you're doing in office?
Well, it doesn't start when we arrive at ESPN. It probably could be starting the night before when I've come home from the prior day, and we have an idea what we want to do the next day. So I'll spend a little bit of time, sometimes maybe several hours, working ahead towards what we're going to do the night before, the next day, with some research or whatever. But I'll get up at 5 in the morning, go out for my morning walk, and I'll be reading my phone the whole time. You know, what's on the night note, what happened overnight, what are the clippings that have come in, what's in the Times, what's in the London Times. So I do about 3 miles. And so during that time, avoiding cars and whatnot down by the harbor, I'll try and get caught up, listen to some radio as well on the phone, get back to the house, get into the office around 7:45, see some of the folks for the meeting. Maybe we'll have a pre-show meeting. Our editorial meeting will begin at 8 o'clock. for a 2:30 show, so you've got to get locked and loaded because that's not a lot of time, just the way the day falls. And we'll spend 45 to 60 minutes. Some days it's pretty obvious what's going to happen. Some days it's not. But we'll kick it around. We'll come to a conclusion. Sometimes there's blood on the walls, metaphorically. Sometimes it's not metaphorically, not kidding. And we'll agree on a topic and an approach that, you know, shows that we're trying to, you know, give an OTL slant on something that might be treated otherwise elsewhere. Some days it's a show that just jumps right out at you, you have to do. We'll agree on who we're going to shoot for guests, whether we need to pull a specific bunch of tape to maybe fashion a little treatment at the top of the show. I will leave that meeting at 9 o'clock. I'll go back to my office, do a little bit of research. I got to jump into makeup, unfortunately, rather quickly, because I then go up to the studio, which is literally a closet, and record our digital promo, the one you see me not wearing a necktie on. I'll record that about 9:30 or 9:45, where I've got a foot-operated teleprompter. I'll write the copy. So that'll get edited and get out on the Internet as soon as we can, because there's this thing called the worldwide interwebs, they tell me, is able to reach people. Then it's to into the research and writing of the show. Some days more easy than others, but I'll give you a perfect example as we progress towards, you know, our 2:30 show, which by about 1:30 I'm going to want to be, you know, getting my makeup touched up, get my necktie on, and leave for the studio, which is across the campus, by about 2 o'clock. Earlier this week, as you and I are talking, a couple of days ago, we had a show ready to go. And how do you define a modern dynasty? And this was off the Chicago victory, the Blackhawks, in the Stanley Cup Finals, where Gary Bettman had proclaimed a dynasty. And we said, you know, that's a pretty good idea. We've been talking about it ahead of time. We were full down the road on that show from 8 o'clock in the morning on till about 11:10, when one of the guys, Gary Bender, on the assignment desk said, check what I just mailed you from Twitter, because he was monitoring Twitter. It was the Time story on the alleged hacking by the Cardinals of the Astros. So I said, holy crapola. So I read this, and I said, Steve Vecchione's right there, my coordinating producer. I sent him the link, sent that to our show producer, Paul Palmer, who was downstairs at the moment, found our senior CP, was in the meeting by email, said, read this now, please. And after about 5 or 10 minutes, independently and then as a group, as much as we could gather, he said, we have to do. It's kind of like Wile E. Coyote. We pull, you know, pull it out of the closet and punch it down on the detonator and blow up the show. We blow up the show. So it's about 11:20. We're 3 hours from airtime now, and we're blowing up the show. And so at that point, well, what do we need? Well, we need somebody in each city, St. Louis and Houston. And we got Richard Justice from MLB.com in Houston. We get a columnist from the Post-Dispatch. We need a cybersecurity expert. For that, we lean on our good friends at ABC News. We email them, and they were able to give us about 4 or 5 names who were able to procure that person. And so you basically, you know, react in a crisis mode. We got less than 3 hours to pull it together. We start pulling out quotes from the Deadspin article that showed the Astros had been hacked. So we're looking through that and give us some good ideas of what was on there with good names. We get that. We got to get those graphics built. We got to get them built quickly. We booked Michael Schmidt of the New York Times, who had done a phoner with SportsCenter, but now we're going to get him to a camera studio in Washington, D.C. We need to get him a car service, so our desk is working on that. All of that, independent of each other, in their own little concentric orbits, people are getting their jobs done. So that at about 2:05, I could walk into the studio and pre-voice a little portion of the tease. We were going to be able to pre-record the top of the tease with a lot of different things. When you see things behind me and the monitor changing, call the RP, the rear projection. Some days we tape that just because you want it to hit exactly with your copy. That day, I think we had to do it live, and then we're off and running. But that was done on that particular day in about 3 hours, and that will occur, I'd say, you know, 3 to 4 times a month to blow up a show. So it looks easy. We want to make it look easy, but we'll finish the show at 3 o'clock. We'll have a little autopsy on it, and we'll kick around. You know, maybe we have something already planned for the next day, but, you know, you're never off. So you're always, you know, at a red light driving home, checking your email. Same thing at home. So that, in a not-so-condensed form, is process.
Bob, there's obviously a number of people who work on Outside the Lines, from producers to researchers, et cetera. You have been the face of that show since its beginning, so obviously you have great input in that show. Specifically, how much input do you have on a daily, weekly basis on the story and storylines that we see as viewers?
It's a very collaborative environment, but you know, the shows that where you see the longer enterprise pieces on Sunday, I just don't have the time to get to all the specific green light meetings that go on with that. but I'll certainly have some input into some of the guests that we book. I'll have questions about different treatments within the story, and it's a very collaborative environment. On a daily basis, it's, you know, I think everybody has a voice at the table, but, you know, I make it, not trying to, you know, throw the anchor monster weight around, but, like, you want to be comfortable with what you're doing and the treatment and the way you do it. But at the end of the day, Rich, I'm very fortunate. I'm able to shape what I say. I write my own copy, always have, always will. That's the best part of the job. So you're able to shape the treatment. So while you're saying, like, you and I are sitting here tomorrow, we're planning a story, and then there'll be a replay because of all the issues that have come up about that. But, you know, how we're going to open the show, how we're going to shape it, what reference we'll give it, that's largely in my hands. Now, you know, we're going to talk about the copy I write, and we'll talk about it as a group, and if we need to make changes, we will. But, you know, I'm very fortunate. I'm surrounded by a lot of very smart people who have a lot of very good ideas, and nobody's got a monopoly on them.
Bob, you know, one of the stories, obviously, that that OTL recently did that, you know, caused a big stir in the quote-unquote marketplace of ideas was the Hope Solo story.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting – there's a number of interesting facets about that that I want to ask you about, because these are things I think that readers and listeners were thinking when the story broke. And the reporting on that by Mark Fenerotta was outstanding. A couple of things. First off, would ESPN have done this story if ESPN was still a rights holder of the World Cup?
Well, I mean, obviously – that's a hypothetical question, and you walk down, you know, it's easy to say yes. I think the answer is yes. I have no reason to think otherwise, because I know how, I won't say skeptical, how open, clear-eyed we were about FIFA during the years that we carried the World Cup, the Men and Women's World Cup, and you can go back and look at our reporting. Now, was it down to that granular level with the U.S. team? There weren't any issues, I think, comparable with the U.S. team. I mean, there's one now with the men. What's going to happen to Clint Dempsey after right. his misconduct the other night? If this were a year later in league play, we'd be smack dab in the middle of some important qualifiers, as it is qualifying isn't beginning until November. I want to, Rich, it's easy to say yes, and everybody's going to say, oh, yeah, sure, prove it. Well, you can't. But I really don't think that the answer would be no, because I know the level of independence and energy behind what we do in the enterprise area, and I know the separation between church and state, and I know the support we get from the top of the company. And having said that, if you've got a good story, it's a good story, you're going to go forward and do it.
Let me ask you about the timing of this, because I know you've been, I don't know if you've been publicly asked this, but I know that this question has certainly come up in the offices at Fox Sports. The watching the Women's World Cup, and I know Bob is, and we'll get to soccer, and I know how, you know, sort of devout you are for all kinds of soccer, not just U.S. soccer, but global soccer. When the conversation came up with Fox's studio analyst about OTL's Hope Solo story, some of the criticism, specifically from former U.S. national team players, was about the timing of the story. What was not said, but what was clearly implied, was that ESPN released this story on the eve of Fox's World Cup to put a damper on Fox's coverage. What is your sort of response to the idea that ESPN was playing games with the timing?
Who was dismissive of the story. And look, I wish we had enough time to plan with such deviousness. And I wish, if that were the case, I would be tunneling into the U.S. Mint. I would put that gene in my makeup to better use. By the way, if anything, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on this, but I think you know it's true. If anything, the rule is any attention is good. Just spell your name right when you want to talk about making a splash for ratings points.
Right.
So if anything, if you want to live in cynical land, it would be, geez, it helped them. So, and I can't believe that was a universally shared opinion, because I do know and have friends behind and in front of the camera. So the timing of the story was the timing of the story. The nature of the story, was already being worked on. I mean, we're talking about Mark Fenerotta, folks, you know, whose track record on Barry Bonds and on concussion and League of Denial, along with his brother Steve, is impeccable. As good a reporter as I've ever met in my life, personally and professionally. That story was in the works before the GMA interview in February. It was a different story at that point. I mean, what I'm telling you, I believe, is nothing different than what has been said publicly, but if you haven't heard it, I'll, you know, listen. When Solo's half-sister saw the GMA interview, she had a change of heart about speaking publicly because she to her mind, thought that Solo was throwing her nephew and Teresa's son under the bus and was not speaking truthfully. That changed her willingness to speak with our reporter and producers. And from there, the story changed. From then, you're into acquiring documents and whatnot. So the story was not in any reportable shape until we were getting towards, you know, late May. And that's just, that's the truth. I was in the middle of all that. I can tell you that, you know, there was no design here. It was what it was. It was a story that came together as it did.
Bob, one last one on that. One of the things, and I, in the midst of writing about Fox's discussion on this story, was I noted and praised, by the way, outside the lines for, and Mark Fenner-Water specifically, for really making note of the fact that the GMA interview was quite soft on Hope Solo, and you can almost make the argument was auxiliary PR for Hope Solo. Was that tough for OTL to do, given that GMA, ABC, you're all part of the lovely Disney family?
It is a lovely family, and it's a marvelous Thanksgiving feast we have together. But again, remember, the facts of the case as we reported them were not known until Teresa Ulmert saw the GMA interview. Now, I don't know to what extent GMA expended energies in trying to report out various facets of the story. To get simply getting Hope Solo to speak about it, we would have done the same thing in February. If Hope Solo wanted to sit down and grant an interview to me or to anybody else, and I've dealt with Hope at the Women's World Cup back in 2011, we would have taken that and we would have, you know, researched as best we could, and we would have asked whatever questions. But again, Teresa Ulmert was not speaking at that point. So we're kind of conflating different elements along the time-space continuum here. So it's real easy to say, well, that wasn't a full report from our good friends at GMA. They were dealing in a different set of realities at that moment, too, because it was their interview which spurred Ulmert's desire to speak. So I can't say that I'm aware it was an uncomfortable moment because of the fact that just the way things developed, it was, you know, different things unfolded along the timeline.
All right, as the lawyers say, asked and answered. I appreciate that.
Yeah, basically.
In terms of one of the things that you have really been exceptional at throughout your career is handling live news, handling a news-breaking situation on live television. How does one get skilled at handling a news-breaking situation on live television?
I don't know. I've done a fair share of it, and after a while it kind of becomes second nature. I think it's just a matter of, I mean, not to sound facile about it, but I think some of it comes, I did a lot of play-by-play growing up in this industry, you know, in high school and in college, and when I got out of college, I first started doing television in New Jersey, a local cable system, Suburban Cable, which has now been sold and bought several times over, but probably doing 200 events a year. Trying to hold the fort together with, it was a very sophisticated production, but, you know, not as sophisticated as you'd like. So my point is, you're in situations where you've got to basically hold the fort and do things, do election coverage with three cameras and people phoning things in the late 70s. So you kind of develop that skill. And so aside from that, I mean, I don't know. How can some people throw a 95-hour, you know, fastball or hit the upper 90 and bend it around the wall? Until you try it, you may not, you know, realize you can do it. So I appreciate your kind words, but it's just a matter of, I think, learning to edit yourself as you're going along. And I think Jeremy Schapp and I were that was the toughest part when we were dealing with the Boston Marathon bombing several years ago. So we picked up that story and we're on the air for a number of hours. I mean, you're dealing with straight facts coming in. Some are allegations, some are reports, and you're trying to be responsible, but at the same time trying to put out what you believe to be true. And that particular evening, I mean, the big question was this terrorism? And as you gathered more and more facts and they came in and you understood these were two bombs, they were set to go off seconds apart, hundreds of yards apart, and eventually I think we said on the air, it starts to look like a terrorist act. You didn't need a federal agent to tell you that. But it's the more times you're in that situation like that, that's where experience, I think, really helps you.
Is it, you know, I think even the best broadcasters have moments on live television where they look back on something and, you know, are like, man, that, you know, that either wasn't good or that was really, really bad, or thank God that that ended quick. Anything for you looking back in your years of live television where the ball went south and it really could have gone south for you?
Well, I remember we were on the air in the minutes, literally, we got on the air within 18 minutes after the San Francisco earthquake hit in 1989 at Candlestick Park. And Candlestick will always be my favorite ballpark because we were having this conversation in 2015. We were told the next day that that earthquake had hit the year before and they hadn't reinforced the concrete wind baffle around the top of it. It would have crumbled in a 7.1 earthquake. So we got on the air, and it's, I think it's an often-told story, but you know, because we had auxiliary power, we were on diesel and not electricity for our truck because we didn't have the baseball contract yet. We're way out beyond the center field fence. We're on the air, and we're doing what we were able to do, which is interviewing cops, talking to people who are around, turning around whatever tape we could pull off the satellite. And one of the pieces they rolled in from Bristol, and I was able to see in my return monitor, was that shot where a section had fallen out of the Bay Bridge. And you actually saw a car, I believe, drive down into it. Hmm. We had just come across that bridge on the way to the game. And, you know, I was five rows from the top of the stadium when the earthquake hit. And so was Chris Berman, who was there with me, Chris Myers, Joe Torre was working with us. And we're all trying to process this. And we immediately got thrown into doing this. And everybody reacts differently. And your adrenaline is going. You don't have time to think about what the heck was going on. People ask me, how long was the earthquake? And I tell them it was long enough to start a Hail Mary, not long enough to finish one. But then, you know, we had to go do what we had to do. But the sight of that bridge with the platform that had fallen, basically collapsed, and a driver going in. And I don't watch that tape much. I probably have watched it three times in the 20-some-odd years since. It is a catch in my... I vividly remember how I felt in that moment. You come close to losing it. It's like, Jesus, that could have been us. I mean, it could have been a lot of people. A lot of people came across that bridge. And the miracle of that day is that it would hit at 5:04, which was rush hour, because it was an Oakland-San Francisco series. And had it hit at a full rush hour, there were only 66 fatalities, and you know, God rest those souls. But you would have had multiple more if it had hit on a normal rush hour day.
I want to ask you some questions about Outside the Line specifically. And I will proselytize as my intro here and let the listeners know for sure. These are my words, not Bob Lee's words. For many, many years, I've written repeatedly that Outside the Lines has been given short shrift by your programming department as it switches between ESPN and ESPN2 and back to ESPN2 and back to ESPN. I think a lot of listeners and readers don't know this, but the real facts are that you lose 50%, if not more, of your audience from switching from ESPN to ESPN2. Those are the reality of television. And when you lose those eyeballs on the prime network, that's a big deal. Your management can say, hey, we give people the opportunity to look at this online and through podcasts, et cetera. But that, and again, these are my words, that is essentially, in my opinion, burying a product. That said, I realize you can only go so far on this, but why over the years, in your opinion, has this happened? Because the show, when it comes to critical acclaim and professional acclaim, Emmy Awards, et cetera, there's no arguing this. You can't stack up OTL's reputation. You can stack up OTL's reputation against the best of the best, the front lines and places like that. So why does the show, in your opinion, continue to be moved year after year come fall?
Well, I mean, I'll have a very frank conversation with you. I mean, why do we open the doors in the morning, Rich? Why do we exist here?
Well, it depends. I mean, at Sports Illustrated, sometimes we don't even have doors, Bob. We just literally we float right through.
But the answer is to build shareholder value for the people who own stock in the Walt Disney Company, right?
Right.
This is not a 501(c) charity. This is a business where everything is a business decision, and there are, you know, the fact is ratings do matter, and over time. If you have a show that's relating to the NFL, like NFL Insider is a very well-done show, a show that can use the NFL shield because it's part of the NFL contract that has a generous allotment of NFL highlights, especially in season, versus a show that's issue-oriented, may not have as many highlights, it's inevitable that, especially in season, is going to rate better in a time slot. So it comes down to the numbers game, the numbers first being ratings, and then the numbers being revenue. And look, we're not thrilled about the bouncing ball. We still don't know, as you and I are having this conversation, that may change by the time, I have no idea the time, but we're still waiting to hear what happens on July 13th, whether we're going to ESPN2 or whether we will remain on ESPN1 in some capacity. Our show on Sundays will remain on ESPN until early into September because, it all revolves around numbers, and so many of the numbers at this network, and this is no surprise and this is no industrial secret, revolve around the National Football League. And we pay a fair amount of money to have the business partnership with the league, and we have to monetize, amortize, and, make it all back. And the people who make those decisions aren't acting out of any sense of malice or desire to bury the show or entomb the show. They're making smart business decisions, and sometimes those business decisions can be discouraging to those who are on the wrong side of them. But we salute and move on. But again, we have a very proud history that we're, and what we've been able to put up there, the skins on the wall, the awards, they're nice, but just the quality of the work day in and day out. So we'll see what will happen for the Daily Show coming up. But either way, I mean, we're proud of our product, and you're right, there's the podcast, there's the digital world, and, this linear world of television that is tied to ratings. I mean, we don't know where it's heading in 10 or 15 years. I mean, the eyeballs and the fact that you've got 500 channels at home and you can watch in so many different ways. So it's distributing the show is, we try and tweet as much as we can and links and whatnot. We're very aggressive in that regard. But still, it is a television show at first, and we'll be celebrating our 25th anniversary, in fact, July 7th with our special, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. He's hitting a shameless plug.
Do it. Promo it up.
Like he's sitting on Carson's sofa here. It would be Johnny Carson. Kids, Google it.
Not Ben Carson, Bob.
Not Ben Carson. Turn your head and cough. But we wait to see what the decision will be. But, yeah, it's business, which, again, is something that was said in The Godfather.
Have you has the staff felt pressure, because it's a business and ratings game, to do more shows that, let's say, are NFL-centric or more shows that can bring in a couple more ratings points because they will attract more eyeballs because they're popular stories, per se?
No, that's a very good question. It's a question sometimes, it will rattle around here, but the message we get is do the right show. The right show is the best show to our mission. And, with guys overseeing our show like Craig Bengston and Craig Lazarus, guys with, and David Brofsky, people who really, understand the news business, and I think I do a little bit too, we're going to do the right show. Now, if you have two topics that are neck and neck on the table in your 8 o'clock editorial meeting in the morning, you might say, well, that might draw some more eyeballs. But one show, two shows, three shows over the course of a month aren't going to make that much of a ratings difference if you make ratings-based decisions, Rich, to make basically over a full three-month period, if you go quarter by quarter, you're not going to move the needle that much. So we set out to do the best shows we can. And, last September, in a crass TV ratings point of view, was absolute manna from heaven, even though we're on ESPN2 at that time of the year, because of the difficulties in the National Football League and the crisis there, the crisis of leadership and management and all the stories. So you had the hottest national stories, and they were tied to the NFL, so you had a confluence that worked in your favor, as if you're just going for eyeballs. But again, you're just doing the best show that you can.
Bob, how do you? And this is—I mean, this question's a little unfair, but I will ask.
Oh, from you, that would never be.
I will ask it anyway. How do you reconcile the parts of ESPN that are journalistically opposite of what you guys do outside the lines?
Look, when I started, you could fit this company in a small boardroom and have a little overfill for the coffee out in the hallway. That was back in 79. We are, 6,000 or 7,000 people? This place is so huge. I remember one of my trips to Brazil, we went to São Paulo, and we visited the ESPN Brazil newsroom. And it was an emotional experience because I felt like I was walking back into the 80s. I mean, but in a good, very good way, the energy, the sense of purpose, and they were like thrilled to meet us, and I was thrilled to meet them because, I mean, our logo on the wall, and they knew us from our work, and we've been working with them for the World Cup. My point being, this is how far flung we are. And even if you're just talking domestically, there's so much stuff going on that you can't expect everyone to be marching in lockstep in point of view, in what they think is important and how they write the same story. It's just impossible. Plus, you know, there's an E in this call side, if you will, entertainment. I mean, this is showbiz, baby. And it is about making money, the network. It is about events. It is about glitz and glamour. And so there is that component to it. So, no, I'm not, trust me, I'm not sitting at home and, you know, get off my digital lawn, you kids doing this and that. No. It's a big tent, so there's room for our show, and there's room for shows that view things differently and take different approaches. And so it's not a matter of reconciliation. It's a matter of celebrating the diversity. And it's not, I'm not quoting from an HR presentation here. It's the truth. It's a big tent.
Bob, let's talk a little bit about soccer, because it's obviously a passion of yours. And it's one of the things that I truly believe in, having talked to him, as well as I think the product just speaks for itself, is your president, John Skipper, is really a big believer in soccer. You can make the argument one of the most important figures in the last decade in this country in soccer, and truly, I think, supports the sport, even though the Premier League is now on NBC and Fox has the World Cup. From your role there, and your role essentially as, you know, the studio voice of ESPN's global soccer coverage, what do you think is going to happen with this company heading forward? Do you think it's going to be a priority to figure out a way to get back into some of the major events that you have had in the past?
I think so. I would hope so. But people keep asking me, you know, what's going to happen with Qatar? Will it go to 2022? And will a 26 World Cup remain with Fox? I mean, that stuff is so far beyond my pay grade and my responsibility. But, you know, we have the European Championships next year. We are going to be aggressively in there bidding on things that make sense. But, again, it'd be nice to say, hey, we have the extra X million it takes to buy this, that, and the other thing, to take the EPL from NBC to have outbid Fox for these World Cups. But that's not the way the business world works. And it just doesn't. So I think John Skipper is a great champion of the sport. He knows the sport. We've discovered independent of each other, we each support Spurs, which is kind of neat. But it's, you know, it's not an uncertain future. It's a future with some unknowns because the EPL is coming up. What's going to happen in terms of Copa America Centenario? Because it was reported that that particular contract had been awarded, but that's all part of the legal proceedings, right, with this U.S. Department of Justice indictment. So there are things outside our control in play as well. They just took 7 terabytes of information, Swiss prosecutors, out of the FIFA headquarters the other day. 7 terabytes, that'll keep them busy for a while. So who knows what's going to unravel. So if things are back in play, I think we'll be aggressive. We have been aggressive, but you don't see a lot of loss leaders here because, again, we open the doors. It's not a charity. It's not a feel-good operation. We're here to make money. If you own Disney stock, trust me, I will tell you, the company is very well run.
Bob, I would say, you know, I have to sort of think about this, but I think a lot of people who write about the stuff like I do and have watched ESPN for decades would certainly, if they don't say the same thing, they would be in very close agreement. Was the 2010 and 2014 presentations of the World Cup, one, the best thing you worked on, and two, do you think that represents the best thing that ESPN has done in its 36-year history?
I'm not qualified to judge whether it's the best thing ESPN's ever done, but nothing I do will ever top it. I've been, you know, helping to elevate, create, you know, the brand here for me just over 36, 37 years soon. And the outside the lines will be able to accomplish ranks right with it. You will see when we close our anniversary show on July 7th that I do a little personal reflections at the end, and a lot of it stems from my travels around the world, reporting for OTL, but in connection with, for example, those two particular World Cups. Those were life-changing events, particularly the one in South Africa,
right,
because it was our first major attempt to truly raise the bar. And the backstories that arose with that nation and that cup. I mean, I think, and then, no exaggeration, I think I read 10 books of various types, Mandela's biography, different takes on the South African experience, getting ready for that cup, made 3 trips over there, and the level of commitment. I mean, you don't talk about commitment from the company for news and information. You know, before we even went over to do the cup, I'd made 2 reporting trips. I mean, that's, you know, that's not cheap. Going to the other side of the world on the, you know, when you go down to Cape Town and you see they're loading in supplies at the docks for boats that are going to the South Pole, you start to realize, cripes, we are at the end of the world here. I mean, there was a major commitment, and the same thing in Brazil. And we could not have done the Brazilian Cup without our good friends and colleagues at ESPN Brazil. And we are very proud, and to still get that kind of feedback, it's very gratifying. And those of us who sat in front of the camera get an undue and unfortunate, uncomfortable amount of the praise, because so many people you'll never see worked themselves literally silly making that happen. And we're very proud of what we did, and I welcome anybody's help. I have many friends at Fox, and I salute their coverage of the Women's World Cup, and I wait to see what they do in Russia, and I wish them all well.
Russia's going to be tough for that company, but their Women's World Cup, if nothing else, the tonnage has been terrific. The images have been really good.
Yes, it has been.
They've done well so far.
They're doing a great job. And, you know, Rob Stone, Alexi, you know, it's like sitting in a hotel bar, but they're drawing different paychecks, and they're doing a great job. They really are.
You, Bob, you are ESPN's longest-running on-air personality. I believe you've been on ESPN as many years as Taylor Twellman's current contract or something. We'll see if Taylor's listening to this. Let me ask you a question about, you know, you just, and we'll talk about this, you just recently signed a contract extension. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
How do you have any kind of sort of career plan as to how long you want to work? Because, you know, what we've seen in broadcasting now, your contemporaries and people older than you have gone well deep into play-by-play, whether it's Brett Musburger, Vern Lundquist, Vin Scully, Dick Enberg is 80. You know, you're not traveling on the road from ballpark to ballpark. There's no reason why you could not, if this is your choice, be on the air another 10, 15 years, et cetera. You may not want that personally, but I wonder, have you thought about how long you would like to continue this run?
Well, the toughest part of sitting down and contemplating these last negotiations was not the negotiations between my representative, Phil DiPicciotto, and the company. I mean, those, I think, were resolved fairly amicably, and there were no real major issues. It was the family discussion about what do we think we want to do. And I just turned 60 a couple of months ago, and despite your disclaimer about the lack of travel, I will tell you that what we do here is physically demanding.
Right.
Because you're on for 8 straight hours. We don't, you know, we eat at our desks at lunchtime, and it's grueling. And you may not look like it on the air, and if we fool you that way, we're doing our jobs. But it is taxing. But I will tell you that I still enjoy what I do, and every day is different. But when I do leave, it's going to be quickly and quietly, and it's going to be probably, I'd rather have people say, gee, why is he leaving than why didn't he leave earlier? Now, I don't want to be Willie Mays in the 73 series. I don't think I'm there. You could probably put that out to a vote. It might be close. But there is, I'm embarrassed by the vigor and the dedication of my friends like Lee Corso, Dick Vitale, Brent. God bless them. I mean, and then they find the joy in continuing to do it, and I enjoy what I'm doing. It's a great, they're mentors in that respect to me. It used to be when you get everybody here, when you get to 55, hey, I'm vested in the pension plan. It's a very good pension plan here. But he said, what am I going to do? You know, my wife says, I married you for better or for worse, but not for lunch every day. So, and, you know, we're here for a while, and we still enjoy it. Boomer stopped in the other day, Chris Berman, and, you know, he's, so now I'm signed a little bit longer than he is. And he makes the point, it's going to be like a mini Minoso situation. If I get beyond 2020, it'll be a 6th decade, because we signed out in 79, like Tim McCarver. You know, he played in the 50s and he played in the 80s. So
back doing 40 games a year for the Cardinals, by the way. Another
exactly.
guy in his 70s.
It's good to hear him, exactly. And you turn over that baseball card, you say, shoot, been here a long time with one team, like George Brett, so it's kind of neat.
Would you consider working elsewhere at any point of your career, let's say in the last 10 to 15, 20 years?
Oh, there have been opportunities, without a doubt. And I don't want to get specific. There have been conversations and opportunities. And, you know, everybody goes through a period when you wonder. And if anybody says it's not true, they're not telling you the truth. Because you always have that moment. You say, well, you know, is the grass greener or should I be treated better about this, that, the other thing? You know, Rich, I don't have a job, and the guys I work with, the colleagues on the air, we don't have jobs. This is like we're living the dream. When you stop and consider what our first world problems are, please. So you sometimes you need to, you know, slap yourself silly upside the head and say, wait a minute, a little perspective is needed here. But, you know, there have been opportunities to have these conversations. But as I said, it's nice to be at that point in your life and in your career where the discussion is not necessarily, you know, do I want to resign because I need the job? But, you know, is this something I want to continue doing just for my lifestyle and whatnot? And we thought about it. We looked at it. We said, it makes sense. Let's continue doing it.
Bob, one of the things that you deal with a lot of material that's hard news that could cause one to be cynical about sports, but your passion is obvious still for journalism, for sports journalism. Somebody like Howard Cosell, when he got to a certain age, became very cynical, almost bitter from being on the air. That, you know, you mentioned guys like Vitale, who are, you know, like the Pied Piper of happiness, Musburger, you know, he's more happy than anything else being in Oxford, Mississippi, or Gainesville. So for you, even though you work in material that sometimes breeds cynicism, why do you think you still have the passion and zeal for coming into work every day?
Because we get to do journalism. I'm not going to tell you that there aren't times when you'll sit there and scream impolite words about somebody trying to dodge you on a story or the latest petulant athlete, at least as you perceive it, you know, doesn't, you know, piss you off a little bit, this, that, the other thing, or I've seen that before. But, again, you have to take a deep breath and put everything in perspective. You know, the line between skepticism and cynicism can be a thin one. And some days, if you feel yourself slipping towards cynicism, you just want to make sure it doesn't make its way onto the internet. Unless, of course, it's FIFA, in which case you tear up the release right. On the air because, Christ, they burned that right.
Can't be cynical enough about FIFA.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's the Pinot Noir of attitudes towards FIFA. But I understand what happened to Cosell. But I, for example, We taped an interview with Senator John McCain yesterday that will appear on this coming Sunday show that involves a boxer who had a series of strokes after what he claims, or his family claims, is poor medical treatment. And talking to Senator McCain about boxing and reform, which is familiar territory, and it's not the first time I've interviewed him about it, but at the end of the interview, the last question is, knowing what we know about concussions, does your sport, the sport you love, the sport you've championed, does it have a future? I fully expected him to give me a more happy-faced response, but he actually seemed to have doubts about it, which kind of flew in the face of some of the other responses in the interview. And you get to a moment like that, and you say, wow, here's a national respected voice on boxing. You get a chance to put a question to him, and you hit the bullseye. And you get to a moment like that, and you say, wow, there are days when some of the things you find on this show are interesting, and you leave, you say, yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty neat that we were able to evince a response on this or that. And if you can have two of the 5 days of the week, you walk out of the office feeling, that was a damn good show. I mean, they're all good. They're acceptable. But we know when we've, like, you know, it was like a sharp ground ball to short or maybe a flare single. That was a double of the gap today. That was good.
All right, we'll finish up with a couple quick ones here. How much influence do you want in picking an outside-the-line successor if the show continues after you?
I'd probably be Stephen Colbert. I would like to have a little bit of input, but I wouldn't pretend that the way that this place is structured, that it would have a lot, and who knows when that would be. But, I would like to think that I've offered some advice on a few things along the way and some things, and maybe it's been listened to and maybe it hasn't been, but I'd like to think that my viewpoint has some value, but, you know, that's not the job. I'm not the managing editor, per se, officially, and that's not the gig.
You and OTL have received many journalism awards and honors, specifically individually. Where does the Men in Blazers Golden Jacket for you lie on the Bob Lee resume?
Now you've reduced me to a puddle of tears. I can't describe it. I was, you know, every morning I stumble into the, after I get, you know, it's about 6 in the morning, time to get dressed, I stumble in and look at, which dark suit will I wear today? And they're staring at me in the back of the closet is the Golden Blazer. In fact, I saw Julie Fowdy walking around the hall the other day. We're the only two living members of the recipients of the Golden Blazer. That was one of the funnest evenings when you work with Raj and Devo. And the night I was awarded the Blazer, that was like, it's a rush to get that stand. He said, now you understand how you could stand on a balcony, say ridiculous things and feel empowered. Kind of like when we were on Broadway last year before the World Cup. Same thing Ian and I were fated by the boys. It's a lot of fun. It is, and it meant a lot. And the friendships and the fraternity in that sport are something I treasure. They really are.
Yeah, those two guys are good. And by the way, and I'll give Julie Fowdy some praise here. Julie Fowdy, as you know, Bob, is fantastic to work with. Can remember in the Sochi Olympics working as an ESPN reporter. Now, again, this is one of the great women's soccer players of all time, but she acts legitimately like one of these 1950s reporters who just loves to hang out, does her work, lugging her, you know, laptop back and forth to the arena, just likes talking to newspaper reporters. So God bless Julie Fowdy. Julie Fowdy is the definition of a good egg, in my opinion.
She is, and she's a working journalist. She, even having played for this nation, for example, in talking to her on air about the Hope Solo case, her objectivity and her ability to separate her life experience from what she needs to, you know, analyze now is remarkable.
Absolutely.
Who doesn't like Julie or love her?
Totally, and absolutely, and has become actually a very good reporter in transitioning from being a terrific player. So props to Julie. All right, finally, Bob, I'd be curious, if you could broadcast any other event that your current network does not own, and Lord knows you guys own a lot, what would it be? You've already done the World Cup, you did the NFL draft, but curious, is there something out there that in this sort of dream scenario you would love to be the host of?
Well, I can remember at the age of 7, my uncle was an assistant director for ABC Wide World of Sports, and this is 1962, and this series was on the air 1 year. And it was this moment, he took me to an event, and I got to stand there in this rickety announce booth and watch this guy call the event and spend a little time in the truck. And I was only 7, but that's the moment when it bit the bug, and I said, wow, this thing TV looks pretty interesting. A demolition derby. That was the neatest damn thing I'd ever seen. And if we ever get the rights to it, I'm going to be first in line with the Golden Blazer.
You might see that on ESPN 8 eventually, the Ocho.
Well, if it rates well, it'll be on ESPN.
No doubt. If it rates well, maybe it plays OTL.
Anything can happen, Rich. We get up with a smile on our face.
That's good.
And a song in our hearts.
You're the Kofi Annan of this podcast. Congratulations for that. All right, Bob Lee is ESPN's longest-serving commentator, joined SportsCenter on the third day of its operation, September 9th, 1979. You know him from his work on Outside the Lines, that show, inception May 1990, coming up on a major anniversary, July 7th. And, of course, Bob, you know his work as well from soccer, host of the 2014-2010 World Cup, 2011 Women's World Cup, also a lead commentator at the World Cup in 1998. I've given his resume once again. Bob Lee, we really appreciate you being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Thank you so much.
It's been absolutely my pleasure, Richard. Your pleasure, Richard. Thank you so much.
All right, back in the studio with producer Bette Marston. Our thanks to Bob Lee, who, when I started this podcast, was one of the people I really wanted to get on. Anyone listening already knows my thoughts on Outside the Lines. I think it's consistently the best thing that ESPN has done, at least in terms of sort of a daily production. They are the journalism beacon of that place. And, you know, Bob Lee has a nickname there, the General. A lot of people call him the conscience of ESPN. That's sort of another nickname, if you want to call it a nickname, that he has. And the guy walks the walk, to be blunt, as someone who's covered that place for a long time. Bob Lee is the reason that you see a lot of the reporting on those network airwaves. You have to have people who have some juice with management to push things through. And Bob Lee is one of those people who have really represented and respected journalism well. I bring in Bette Marston. Now, you know, I think Bette is, you know, in a weird way, maybe Bob Lee does not get enough credit for being a great sort of traditional host. You know, you think of the hosts there like, you know, Mike Tirico or Reese Davis, Chris Fowler. But as a soccer host, he really has been one of the better soccer hosts that this country has seen in the last 20, 25 years.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I really thought it was really interesting how he gave us the insight of how they completely scrapped that whole show about the Blackhawks. As a Lightning fan, I'm obviously very pleased with
that.
Yeah,
it was a rough one for you.
Rough one for me and all of Tampa Bay. All of our players, too. God, poor Tyler Johnson with his broken wrist. But, I, you know, I always find it fascinating how, you know, how quickly everything turned on a dime and how, you know, they had to call up their friends at ABC and get someone to come on and how they were able to pull that all off. And, you know, it's everyone always thinks that, you know, he might have this really easy job, but no, it actually is not at all easy. And, you know, that's kind of the life of a journalist. You know, I see it in my role as a producer. You kind of have, you have to be flexible, and if things change, you have to scrap all of your original plans and, you know, get everything, you know, to be as updated as possible.
Yeah, that's a good, you know, that I'm sure, you know, you can speak to this because, like, as the NFL, as SI.com's NFL editor, you had to deal with Adrian Peterson, and you've had to deal with other breaking news.
Yeah, but we had to, my coworkers and I, we had to, you know, it was a Friday afternoon when the Adrian Peterson news broke, and there was, you know, nothing, you know, none of us really wanted to deal with it at the time, but you can't ignore it, so.
You got to deal with it. That's pretty much journalism on a day-to-day basis, adaptability and, you know, accuracy and, you do your best and you move on to the next day. All right, Bette, I know you don't like long outros or intros, so we will end this here. My thanks to Bob Lee of ESPN. Been working there since September 9th, 1979. That is, you don't even get a gold watch at that point.
He has been working there for almost like
36
like
years.
10 years longer than I've been alive, which is.
Bob will really appreciate that upon hearing this back.
Sorry.
all right, the producer is the aforementioned Bette Marston. I'm Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.